Hello and welcome to this programme discussing the Symphonies of Sibelius, in the cycle performed by the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, with Paavo Berglund conducting at the Helsinki Festival in 1998. They're now available on DVD and Blu-ray from ICA Classics. The catalogue numbers are ICAC 5162 and 5163. The issue marks 10 years since Berglund's death. At the time of the recording, the COE's principal oboe was Douglas Boyd, these days himself a successful conductor, a switch he made only a few years after these recordings. I'm Simon Mundy, and before the DVD was issued at the beginning of 2022, we talked about the bond the orchestra and Dougie himself forged with Berglund. Here's our conversation, recorded via Zoom. In between, there are samples from the Sibelius CD set Berglund and the COE recorded for the Finlandia label, which these days is part of Warner Finland. We began with the joyful scherzo from Symphony No. 1, and through the course of the programme you'll hear, in order, the third movement of Symphony No. 3, featuring Dougie in a cheerful oboe solo in the introduction, and then the slow movement of Mozart's Oboe Concerto K314, performed by Dougie with Paavo Berglund in 1986 for Teldec. After that, we return to Sibelius, extracts from the 6th, 2nd and 4th symphonies, finishing with the magnificent final bars of the 5th, the moment when unfamiliar audiences applaud a chord too soon.
Shall I tell you the story of how it all started? Because actually, Paavo came in the early days to conduct mostly classical repertoire, which he did really well. Haydn symphonies, I remember doing the Haydn Oxford Symphony in Italy. We did all sorts of things with him. But at the end of the programme, we'd almost always do Valse Triste as an encore. And it was incredibly moving. I mean, we often were kind of in tears with this sort of master at work, turning what is a kind of a bit of a potboiler encore into something that was just breathtaking. And it was on one of these tours that, you know, we knew he'd recorded the Sibelius Symphonies with Helsinki. I remember we were sort of sitting down at a dinner, and a group of us said to him, why don't we do the whole cycle and record them? And at first, I think he thought it was absolutely ridiculous, because he was used to having a massive symphony orchestra. And then I think, having worked with COE, first of all, he really loved the kind of response and the initiative and the musicianship in COE. But also what he loved was the transparency and the kind of rhetoric that came, was very much part of our sort of template, if you like, which probably came to a large extent from Harnoncourt in a funny sort of way, actually. He also started thinking about some of the symphonies that were first performed with Sibelius right at the very beginning, that the Helsinki Orchestra was not that large. And it started to grow as an idea. And then we did some performances, I think, I can't remember the order, but we probably did, I've got a memory of doing 6, one of the early performances of 6, which has this kind of almost Baroque feel at times in the 6th Symphony. And we just managed to get him over the edge to say, yeah, let's do this, let's do a cycle. And then with June McGuinness, who was the chief executive, as it were, at that time, or orchestral manager, she had some great contacts, Edinburgh Festival, and then, of course, going to Helsinki, which was like, you know, it was kind of the Messiah coming home, you know. It
was really special. Was he different in Helsinki from the way he was in Britain?
No, but I think what felt very clear at Helsinki was that there was a sense within the public that it wasn't just another conductor, but it was the master that was back home. You know, we were often in tears at the end of these performances, you know. He had an enormous influence on the orchestra, and he had a particular influence on me. And when I started conducting, it was to Paavo that I turned for guidance and to be a kind of mentor in the early days. And it was through the medium of Sibelius, I think, was the way that we bonded. But he was kind of unique. He was unique because I think we were so blessed in Chamber Orchestra Europe to work with, as you know, some of the greatest artists of the last 30, 40 years. But inevitably, with any group of people, you, with even the greatest artists, you're going to get some people, you know, you'll respect people of this incredible quality, but you might not, not everybody will love that particular conductor or soloist or, you know. But the thing about Pavel was that he was universally loved by everybody, really by everybody in the orchestra. So it was this very rare combination of somebody we looked up to musically, particularly in the repertoire of, you know, that he'd spent his life on Sibelius. But there was also this incredible affection towards him.
Berglund was part of an extraordinary school of conducting from Finland, wasn't he, that included people like Jorma Panula. And I just wondered what it was about that school of conducting and about his conducting in particular that made his gestures, his musicianship, so immediately attractive to you.
There was an economy of physical economy. So there was an absolute clarity in that sense of gesture. But I think that maybe it's something I could relate to from my Presbyterian Scottish roots, but there was just this integrity. There was no flashiness of making a gesture that was for the crowd. And I think that always, if you have the musicianship and you have the dedication that he had, again, particularly towards the music of Sibelius, then you could not help but respect and love that kind of combination. I mean, the integrity to the music was to the point where we used to joke that when Pavel came on stage, he often kind of looked up at the audience, and we used to sort of joke that he was thinking inside, "What are you doing here? But I don't know what you're doing here, because we're here to make music. We're here to play the music of Sibelius. Well, I don't know what you're doing here." You know, I mean, he was just completely focused not on the giving the performance, but actually everything was about, we are now dedicated for the next 2 hours to Sibelius.
The thing that Berglund had and that Sibelius shared was this business of coming from the Swedish minority in Finland, of them both being some people who were very much of the Baltic rather than just of a particular Finnish heritage and identity. And I just wondered how much that sense of being outside and inside at the same time came through the music making.
I think in the same way as Sibelius was always an outsider to the middle European great symphonists. So I think there was always that sense of Mahler being to Sibelius, perhaps being in the, although he of course felt an outsider for different reasons, but Sibelius was not part of that Vienna scene. I think he was always a kind of outsider to it. And maybe somewhere, he certainly was never discussed, but maybe Pavel felt the same. I don't know. But I think he did have the advantage of, at least he had a little connection with Sibelius. I think he conducted for him once, and obviously he revered him, you know. There are so many composers where we're led to believe that you have to have something of the smell of that particular part of the world to be able to understand. And I'm in general quite dubious about that. I don't think you have to. I don't think the fact that one is Scottish means that you can't interpret Mahler, for instance. But I do think that in Pavel's case, there was something of the granite and the austerity of the Finnish world that just made him the perfect interpreter for Sibelius's music.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about how you came to move from the oboe to the baton, because that's very much part of your relationship with Pavel Berglund, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That process was enormously influenced by your meeting, but also your time with him.
I was always fascinated by the conductors and by the role of a conductor in an orchestra. And nevertheless, I'm absolutely so glad that I spent over 20 years of my life playing and not being on that side of the fence. But having had when I look back now, incredible sort of honor and luck to work with these extraordinary musicians. You know, both the soloists we worked with, but I think from the conducting point of view, to you know, every tour being sort of Harnoncourt and Abbado, and Berglund was absolutely a key member of that team.
You recorded the Mozart works with Berglund.
Yes, that's right, and that was in fact that was the very, very first recording of anything I'd ever done as a soloist, and I was so lucky that I had Pavel at my side, you know, helping me through it, and I never really made a solo recording, and I didn't even know kind of the protocol of going into the recording studio and listening back and deciding. I was sort of like, I was quite green, actually. And Pavel was very much, without being in any way condescending at all, was a huge support in the professional aspect and the inspirational aspect of making that recording. So he was always a very, very special person to me. And also his wife, Kirsty, who, you know, had her physical issues. As far as I know, she was a victim of polio, you know, so she had a lot to deal with. But she was absolutely at our side and Pavel's side. And I think she kind of said this, that it was a kind of rebirth for Pavel, this relationship with Chamber Orchestra of Europe. So I think it works both, you know, all these things, they have to work both ways.
And then at the other end of your playing career, when you decided to move over to the rostrum, you went and spent a lot of time with him, didn't you?
Not a lot of time, but I did go. I went up to Helsinki and we went to his summer house, which was on one of these archipelago islands near Turku. And, you know, Pavel wasn't a pedagogic teacher where he would say, okay, now we're going to do this and we're going to look at how your gestures are and how do you study this piece. You had to kind of stimulate him in order to get assistance because, without being too stereotypical, he was very good at being silent, you know, or can be part of that northern Nordic mentality. So the obvious thing, of course, was, well, I need to bring some music with him. And I brought Sibelius Six. And that's what we talked about it and how he studied it, how he analyzed it, at the end, what we did was, I mean, it's sort of surreal. We'd also spent quite a lot of time in the sauna as well, and then diving into the cold water. But then after we dried off, I remember after a few days, I said, look, you've never actually seen me physically conduct. And, you know, I don't know whether I'm on the right lines here or whether this is ridiculous. He says, okay, all right, well, okay, play. Let's do the whole symphony. And he got his violin out, which he played left-handed, you know, because he was unusually a left-handed conductor as well. And he played the violin the opposite way around. And somehow, of course, he knows these symphonies so well. He did have the score in front of him somewhere, but he played the whole of the symphony on his violin while I conducted. And then he'd make some comments about, oh, why are you doing that with your left hand? What was the point of that? But it was incredibly helpful, incredibly helpful. So I owe him a huge amount, actually.
It always struck me that Sibelius must be very hard to conduct because he was one of the first composers in the 20th century to do these modular phrases that sort of don't go anywhere very often. They don't turn into huge tunes, that sections come and go all the time. And to get a sense of an arch, to get a through line, must be very hard.
Conductors such as Abbado, where if you opened his score, it would have almost no markings whatsoever. But he had this incredible, not only a photographic memory, but a sort of sense of the journey of a symphony inside his body and inside his brain. And you've got somebody like Harnoncourt, who, if you opened his score, it looked like an encyclopedia in terms of markings. And Pavel was much more of that tendency. In particular, he knew every single harmonic progression. He knew it absolutely. He had written them down in the score, which is something I've sort of learned from him and done myself. And it transformed, I think, the sense of where the journey went. And we used to talk about the fact that he was kind of the first minimalist composer, in a sense, long before, you know, the days of John Adams or Philip Glass or something like that. You know, that you did have these, as you say, these blocks of almost harmonic stillness. It might be moving in terms of a motor rhythm, but the harmonies were staying, to some extent, very stable. But there would always be a breakthrough. There would always be a breakthrough into something else. And I think that was something that he completely understood, that there was not just a melodic journey, but there was a harmonic journey through every movement. And he understood that. It was like the fissure in the granite landscape, and it would open up into the next level. So his analysis plus his fantasy, which I think is what separates great conductors from others, it had this perfect kind of combination, actually.
From the Fourth Symphony onwards, really, transitions become more and more important, don't they? The transitions between these different blocks of melody and these different blocks of harmony become more and more important. Is that something you were very conscious of when you were playing the music, and something that he took great pains over?
I think he did it through his action and through his rehearsing, but he wouldn't talk about it in any particularly analytical way unless I went and sat in his dressing room and talked it through. That's not something he'd really discussed with the orchestra. But he did manage to convey the journey through Sibelius' symphonies about the fact that they get more and more compressed, and that you know, ending, I suppose, with the Seventh Symphony, which feels like an epic that has somehow, like a black hole, like I'm not a physicist, but the idea of the energy of the universe being compressed and compressed into what could have been an hour's symphony, but it's compressed into, I don't know, how long Sibelius, 25 minutes or something, you know? And if you compare that to the First Symphony, which is probably nearer to Tchaikovsky, that was really absolutely amazing to go through that journey with him. I think the other thing that strikes me going back to working with Pavel was that there's quite a lot of ambiguity in Sibelius' scores about what he actually means, and sometimes a lack of instructions. The opposite, going back to Mahler, where you cannot go through a single bar without an instruction in terms of, you know, rubato or crescendo diminuendo or the exact dynamic mark. In that sense, you had to have a kind of classical approach, in the best sense of the word, to Sibelius, because you had to interpret it. In the same way as I always believe that there's nothing harder than conducting a Haydn or Mozart symphony, because he only wrote piano in 40, you know? And saying a little bit shorter here or a little bit longer here is absolutely nowhere compared to what you actually, in my opinion, what you need for these symphonies. And he had the same approach. He had absolute confidence to say you have to interpret. So in a way, there was no truth, but we always felt that he did have the truth. Actually, I find it difficult to compare any other Sibelius cycle, and I know many of them, to having been at the coalface with Pavel.
Take us through the symphonies a bit for this extraordinary set that you did with him. Was there a big difference between the early symphonies, the very romantic symphonies, as you said, the much more compressed later ones? Or did he find a line for Sibelius himself, in a way, from those 1890 symphonies right through to the 1920s ones?
You know, going back to Harnoncourt, he always said about the Beethoven symphonies that he felt that Beethoven was expressing through all the symphonies an argument. I'm talking about Beethoven now. The Third Symphony, for example, I'm paraphrasing, but being about the possibility of what can happen from the smallest embryo. Obviously, there's the Napoleon, you know, the Napoleon illusion, but, you know, the possibilities of the human spirit somehow, of what is possible, irrespective of one's background or where one comes from. And then the Fourth Symphony somehow saying, no, the perfection of the world is, it's not like that. The perfection is in the classical world. And then the Fifth Symphony being about freedom, perhaps, or destiny, whatever you want. I'm paraphrasing, you know. I mean, I remember Harnoncourt saying this. It's like two very good friends having a huge argument about the meaning of life, that one symphony always somehow reacts to the previous symphony. Pastoral Symphony reacts to the Fifth Symphony in the same ways. And I think, perhaps unconsciously, that is the case in the Sibelius symphonies. Now, I don't know if that was something that Pavel expressed consciously, but I think that's what I certainly felt. So I think the First Symphony maybe is perhaps on its own, because it seems to me that it's got some of the harmonic language and unique qualities that are expressly Sibelius, which are difficult to define, but you can say, oh my God, that's the music of Sibelius. But it is more, I think, like the influence that you could almost say it's another Tchaikovsky symphony if you didn't know Sibelius' music intimately. Do you know what I mean? You know, there's something.
Strikes me that those first two symphonies are really quite related to the tone poems in a way that the later ones aren't.
I think that's right. And then for me, the Second Symphony continues that tone poem theme or that romanticism, but he finds his voice in the Second Symphony. And so with the First Symphony, you get these echoes of, say, Tchaikovsky, whereas the Second Symphony is unmistakably the sound world that could only be one composer in the world, and that's Sibelius.
Thank you.
And then I think in the Third Symphony, you're somehow going into this reflection of classicism and economy of gesture. If my memory served me properly, the Third Symphony was something we did very early on as well. And that was a kind of revelation to him as well as to us, that he, if you approached it not that far off from where how Harnoncourt might approach a Beethoven symphony, you suddenly, the inner workings and the rhetoric of the symphony became clear. And then you've got the Fourth Symphony, which is, you know, has that feeling of the end of the world somehow, on the edge of tonality. It's kind of my favorite symphony in a way. You know, it's the one, if I only had one, I mean, I hate these games, but I'll just play it anyway. If I had only one symphony to live with, it would probably be the Fourth, but then nobody wants to hear it. Audiences generally hate it, but I think, well, it's the greatest.
For me, it's very much his Winter Symphony, if you like. There's a barrenness to it, which is quite extraordinary.
It's bleak, but there's also, there's a climax in that slow movement that, you know, it feels that your heart is being torn out. I just think it's one of the greatest climaxes in all the music, and it only lasts a second, and then it subsides, you know? And maybe it's also from my oboe world, but I think the end where you get this, it's a major seventh, it's from a B natural then down to a C natural, if I remember correctly. And there's just something so despairing about it, and the way it ends bizarrely with this minor mezzo forte chord, which is a non-dynamic in a sense. It's neither dying into silence, but it's a kind of like acceptance of something. I'm getting into very dangerous territory because Pavel, coming from that culture, wanted it just to be expressed through the music and didn't want to talk in terms of, well, it means this or it means that. But for the purpose of this podcast, that's what it sort of feels like to me.
And then the middle symphonies are, in a way, more straightforward, aren't they? I mean, the five and six, I think, is almost more straightforward.
Well, certainly five is, and five, along with two, of course, are the two most popular, would you agree? I think the five,
yes,
and
would,
fifth,
yeah.
You know. And, of course, there is the one, having just said that he didn't like to talk about his music, there is the one amazing story on the fifth that, now, am I getting this right? He saw a flock of geese or swans in the Nordic sky, in the Finnish sky. And it was the most, oh my, he says something, I think it's to his publisher, he said it was the most beautiful sight I've ever seen. I have the theme for a symphony. It's just given me this inspiration. And then he says that when he finished the last note of the Fifth Symphony, he looked outside and these swans circled the house and flew away. And he felt it was a kind of incredible heavenly signal, if you like. And the reason I'm telling you this story, of course, is that the swan theme is the fantastic mantra of the last movement, after the strings have this incredible kind of agitated, energized, manic scrubbing playing at the beginning. Going back to our early discussion about the sense of minimalism and where is it going harmonically, it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. It seems to be just, we're in this kind of mad, agitated world, and then it breaks through, I think, to C major, actually. and you get this unbelievable melody in the horns over chords in the strings, which Pavel got everybody to play non-divisi. In other words, that you don't split the chords. Everybody has to play double stops, non-vibrato. And so you get this kind of geese sound, if you like, but a sort of sound from the earth, absolutely from the earth, with this extraordinary landscape of horns over the top. That was always another moment in a concert where he was like, oh, you know, we have to get to the end here and be professional, you know?
It is a wonderful cycle, and it's a wonderful interpretation. And has it been in the back of your mind as a conductor over the years?
Well, I haven't been asked to do a cycle, so I'm getting let's get the words out. I've conducted every symphony except the first, funnily enough. Of course, you tend to get asked to do the second and the fifth more than anything else. The fifth also has a slightly poignant resonance for me because it was about the 20-something of March 2020, the day before we all locked down for the next year. And I was at the Sheldonian Theatre with the Oxford Philharmonic doing Sibelius V. I mean, it probably should never have gone ahead. Absolutely packed out, everybody doing a concert in the most normal circumstances. And they played wonderfully, actually. And it was Sibelius V. And then got home, and the next day the world stopped. And so I'll always remember that Fifth Symphony.
There's a great tradition, of course, of Scottish conductors doing Sibelius. I mean, going back to Alexander Gibson.
Well, that's another connection, actually, in my little narrow world, is that although I probably wanted to become a professional footballer and play for Scotland when I was 13 or 14, my interests were pretty bipolar because the other thing was playing music. So I had this weird obsession between music and sport. And my teacher was Michael Watts, who was the principal of what was then the Scottish National, but it's now the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. It was not only the height of the Gibson years, who did a lot of Sibelius, but one of their guest conductors was much younger, Pavel Berglund. And the first time I saw Pavel conduct was at the City Halls in Glasgow. And for me, I was a program seller, which I think I got absolutely no money for, but it meant I could just go and listen to all this. I learned a hell of a lot of symphonic repertoire just going to SNO concerts on a Saturday night in Glasgow. And that was the first time I heard and saw Pavel. And I probably heard all the Sibelius symphonies with Alec.